Democracy Now!, Shanana Gusmao. He fought in the mountains against the Indonesian army for 17 years. He was imprisoned in an Indonesian jail for 8 years. Now he's the founding president of a new East Timor. Today, an interview. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush and his top advisors were informed by the CIA early last August that terrorists associated with Osama bin Laden had discussed the possibility of hijacking airplanes. Until now, the Bush administration has insisted the attacks of September 11th could not have been foreseen by U.S. intelligence. The London Guardian is reporting President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed to set up a joint committee designed to head off Russian opposition to Bush's Star Wars plan. The agreement is also expected to undermine resistance to national missile defense in Western Europe. The initiative will be unveiled when Bush visits Putin in Russia next week. The murdered Dutch far-right anti-immigrant politician Pim Fortuyn reached from the grave last night to capture second place for his party in the country's general election. The ruling Labour Party suffered a humiliating meltdown. The U.S. government has quietly released to Congress a report refuting the Israeli claim that Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is directly implicated in the funding and planning of attacks against Israeli civilians. Colombian government troops and right-wing paramilitaries are fighting with rebels northwest of Bogota. Over 30 have been killed. Meanwhile, a UN fact-finding team is charging the Colombian government failed to heed danger signs ahead of a rebel attack which killed over 100 civilians in Bojaya earlier this month. 40 members of Congress called yesterday for unrestricted U.S. travel and increased trade with Cuba. The appeal came one day after former President Jimmy Carter delivered a speech in Havana urging the lifting of the economic embargo. The Bush administration quickly announced that it intends to intensify the embargo by tightening enforcement of financial and travel restrictions to Cuba. Those are some of the headlines. You're listening to Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier in East Timor. Today we're standing in front of the Motayal Church. 10 years ago, on November 12, 1991, young people just like this, thousands of them, gathered outside the church. They weren't holding xylophones and cymbals and drums. They were holding banners that said things like, "Why the Indonesian military shoot our church?" They came out of the church where the nuns are now watching this procession. But in that day, they marched. And it wasn't Timorese who were coming along in jeeps to watch a parade. It was the Indonesian military that lined the route. Today, it's young people. They're practicing for the Independence Day celebration on Sunday. Then, too, it was young people who pulled the banners written on bedsheets out of their blouses from their schools, the kinds of blouses that we see today. Today, they're celebrating. In 1991, they were gunned down. This is the new East Timor. Today, we go back in time to a radio documentary journalist Alan Nairn and I produced more than 10 years ago on the history of East Timor and the Santa Cruz Massacre. Then, a wide-ranging interview with rebel leader-turned-president Shanana Gusmao.
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
Two American newsmen badly beaten, Mr. Alan Lairn and Ms. Amy Goodman.
The Indonesian army converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire on the people.
Well, we pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights.
Military assistance programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable.
Now
Massacre, the story of East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman.
Big countries with powerful military machines should not be permitted to invade, occupy, and brutalize their peaceful neighbors.
With these words, former Secretary of State James Baker explained why the United States was going to war against Iraq. Yet 16 years earlier, another big country, Indonesia, invaded a much smaller one, East Timor, with the support of the United States. What followed was one of the greatest genocides of the 20th century. It is estimated that up to one-third of the Timorese population has been killed through a policy of army massacre and enforced starvation. Many of those who are left have been imprisoned and tortured by a military armed and trained by the United States. East Timor, a quiet farming nation on a mountainous island about 300 miles north of Australia, had been a Portuguese colony until 1974, when there was a democratic revolution in Portugal and the new government decided to disband its empire. Neighboring Indonesia, a military dictatorship more than 200 times East Timor's size, began attacking Timor in an effort to prevent the island nation from completing its move toward independence. On December 7, 1975, Indonesia launched a full invasion. Timorese shortwave radio, monitored by reporters in Australia, was heard putting out desperate calls for help.
A lot of people are being killed, I repeat.
The night before the invasion, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and President Ford were in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, toasting General Suharto, the Indonesian ruler.
Our relationship involves a common concern for the right of every nation to pursue its destiny on its own independent and sovereign course. On behalf of Mrs. Ford and myself, I raise my glass and propose a toast.
João Carrascalo, the brother of the former governor of East Timor and himself a political leader now in exile, was working for the Indonesians at the time.
I arrived at Jakarta 1 hour before President Ford and Henry Kissinger landed in Jakarta. And on the same night, I was informed by Colonel Sugianto, who was a top officer in the Jakarta administration, that America had given the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor.
The United States, Suharto's main backer, supplied 90% of Indonesia's arms. The story of East Timor is a story few know about, except those who have lived through it. Six foreign journalists who were there as Indonesia attacked were executed by the Indonesian military. Australian TV correspondent Greg Shackleton sent this report the night before the frontier town where he was visiting was seized by the Indonesian troops.
Why, they ask, are the Indonesians invading us? Why, they ask, are the Australians not helping us? Who, they ask, will pay for the terrible damage to our homes? My main answer was that Australia would not send forces here. That's impossible. However, I said we could ask that Australia raise this fighting at the United Nations. That was possible. At that, the second in charge rose to his feet, exclaimed, "Camarada journalist," shook my hand, the rest shook my hand, and we were applauded because we are Australians. That's all they want, for the United Nations to care about what is happening here. The emotion here last night was so strong that we, all three of us, felt we should be able to reach out into the warm night air and touch them. Greg Shackleton is an unnamed village which we'll remember forever in Portuguese Timor.
And it was to be a report Australians would remember. The following day, Indonesian troops moved in and executed Shackleton and his crew. Though the government of Australia ended up siding with Indonesia, the UN Security Council denounced the invasion of East Timor and passed two resolutions, like those later passed against Iraq, calling on Indonesia to withdraw its troops without delay. But United States lobbying prevented any UN action, and as Indonesia began to execute the Timorese en masse, Washington doubled its military aid. Pela nossa nação, pela nossa liberdade. I first arrived in East Timor in the summer of 1990, almost 16 years after the Indonesian army first came ashore. They were still occupying East Timor. I was there with journalist Alan Nairn, a correspondent for the New Yorker magazine.
Dili, the capital city, was honeycombed with army bases and torture houses. There were soldiers on the street corners, secret police watching the market stalls and the public parks. Timorese could be hauled away to the torture houses if they were found speaking to foreign tourists or listening to foreign shortwave radio. There, people would be given electroshock, beaten with iron bars, and at night, soldiers wearing hoods would roam through the neighborhoods, terrorizing the Timorese.
Journalist Alan Nairn and I returned to East Timor for a historic event. A special delegation from the United Nations and Portugal was due to visit East Timor. The Timorese hoped the visit would finally lead to UN action and enforcement of the Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to withdraw from East Timor.
We were told in place after place that the army had been holding neighborhood and village meetings to warn the Timorese that if they tried to speak to the UN Portuguese delegation, they and their families would be killed. And Bishop Bello, the Bishop of East Timor, told us that the threat was, we will kill your family to the seventh generation.
But despite the threats and a dramatic increase in disappearances, torture, and deaths, Timorese had prepared to speak out. They had met in secret, making banners and petitions for the delegation. When the army tried to hunt them down, many had gone into hiding and sought refuge inside churches. But under pressure from the United States, the visit of the delegation had been called off. 3 days later, with the world spotlight removed, the army stormed the Motayal, Dili's main Catholic church, and killed a young man named Sebastião Gomes, who had taken refuge there. And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastião's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come, came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we, as foreign journalists, could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
The soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. The Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood. And the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in, one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis of fear. They were not able to move, some of them, at least in the cemetery, and indeed even in the trucks, when I saw them going by, were barely breathing. When people are that terrified, it's quite often difficult to tell if they're dead or alive.
After 9 hours in custody, Stahl went back to the cemetery under cover of night, dug up his video cassettes, and had them smuggled out of the country. Alan Nairn and I had managed to leave East Timor a few hours after the massacre. From a hospital on Guam, we reported what had happened to dozens of newspapers, radio, and television outlets around the world.
From Washington, this is the Pacifica Report for Tuesday, November 12, 1991. A massacre in East Timor. Among those injured were two journalists, including the news editor of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people, and these were truly...
日本政府はインドネシアに真相究明を申し入れ
Timor, when Indonesian troops opened fire on a crowd...
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military...
Imagens do primeiro... Photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom.
This is the CBS Evening News.
In the face of the massacre story, even Suharto's longtime allies were compelled to condemn the killings and came under public pressure to cut back their aid to Indonesia. In Australia, large crowds marched on the capital and surrounded Indonesia's local consulates. The European Parliament voted for sanctions against Indonesia, and the European community later canceled the scheduled trade pact. There were even open protests inside Indonesia, where student demonstrators were beaten and arrested. You're listening to Massacre, the story of East Timor, here on Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Ask Shanana who is in prison. Ask Shimens who lives in danger. Ask the Australians who were murdered. My God, it was worse than hell. The Indonesians invaded East Timor, taking our women, murdering our children, and then the hundreds of thousands more who won't accept the dictatorship. So then Suharto doesn't take our land. We'll keep on fighting.
This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we continue with the documentary Massacre, the story of East Timor. Back in the United States, the Bush administration continued to ship weapons to Indonesia.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The only time President Bush mentioned East Timor publicly was months after the massacre, when asked about it by a Portuguese journalist.
A lot of discussion is going on the tragedy in East Timor. We have expressed ourselves in terms of the pure human rights part of it. We pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights. And I think we've made clear to the parties that are interested there the U.S. position. I don't know
that position to call for an increase in U.S. military training aid. It's called IMET, International Military Education and Training. More than 2,600 Indonesian officers have been trained under IMET since 1975. They include those who planned the invasion and have overseen the policy of mass slaughter. Immediately after the massacre, General Tri Sutrisno, the national commander of the Indonesian armed forces, gave a speech to a military gathering. He said of the Timorese who dared to oppose the Indonesian armed forces, "They must be shot," adding, "and we will shoot them." Listening to politicians is something José Ramos Horta has been doing for 17 years. He left East Timor at the age of 25, just before Indonesia invaded. He had been sent to the United Nations to plead East Timor's case. While Ramos Horta got out of East Timor alive, much of his family has been killed.
Yes, I lost one sister and two brothers. The sister, she was 17 when she was killed, along with 20 other kids. Two Bronco aircraft nosedive over a village and blew up the school and 20 kids there. One brother was killed when he was captured. Another, we don't know what exactly happened, but he disappeared during a helicopter assault on a village where he was. But like me, there are many, many other families, and in fact, some are even worse. I know families that were totally wiped out, families that I knew, I grew up with, that no longer exist. I know villages. When all my youth I spent there, and when I ask survivors, I'm told, that village does no longer exist. It's not on the map. So this is the scale of the tragedy that was imposed on East Timor with U.S. Complicity.
How do you hold out hope? You've been outside the country for 17 years. You've been the representative of East Timor at the United Nations for more than a decade. What gives you any hope?
Well, the past 17 years that I've been engaged in a diplomatic struggle, I also have witnessed, and all of us witnessed, empires crumbling. No one thought possible 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that the Soviet Union would disintegrate into independent states, or Yugoslavia, or the Berlin Wall, democratization in Africa and elsewhere. And Indonesia will follow the same. It cannot escape the trend of democracy. But apart from that, the resistance in East Timor is continuing at all levels. Armed resistance, one, but also cultural, religious. The entire people are mobilized, and we are very confident. I can state categorically, in the next 3, 5 years, 6 years, maybe a bit longer, East Timor is going to be independent.
Today, José Ramos Horta is the external spokesperson for the Timorese underground and its leader, Xanana Gusmão. Xanana leads the remnants of the Timorese guerrilla resistance, which has been fighting in the hills for 17 years. But perhaps his most important role is as the political leader of the Timorese underground, which advocates self-determination and, as even the Indonesian army admits, enjoys vast support across the political spectrum among the surviving East Timorese. No matter how hard the army has tried to catch him, Xanana has eluded their grasp. He has emerged as the symbol of national resistance, a figure of Nelson Mandela-like stature in East Timor.
We are not saddened with our pain. We open our eyes to the immense suffering of the 16 years. We are not afraid of blood. We think of the determination of our people. The struggle continues on every front.
Early in the morning at 4 a.m., I woke up and I couldn't find anybody. Mother and father, where are you? You left me all alone.
old women in traditional dress of East Timor, young men, young women, little kids, and they marched up to the cemetery. When we got to the cemetery, again, there were thousands of people. The Indonesian army converged in two places. They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people.
The story of East Timor. When journalist Alan Nairn and I produced this documentary in 1992, Shinana Gusmao was the rebel leader of the East Timorese people. He was then captured by the Indonesian military after fighting in the mountains against the army for 17 years, held in an Indonesian prison for 8 years. Now, in just 4 days, he will become the founding president of the new nation of East Timor. This is an interview with Shinana Gusmao. Listening to Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier in Dili, East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by the new president of East Timor, the founding president of a new nation. He is Shinana Gusmao. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, and welcome, Amy. I believe that you are feeling or remembering many things. You were part of some important events in our struggle. Welcome to East Timor.
Well, it's quite remarkable to be back and to see you here in your own homeland. It's been 27 years since the Indonesian military invaded. Where were you on December 7th, 1975? Where were you on December 7th, 1975?
In December of in the day of the invasion, I was in Lois River. Trying to join the volunteer there. In the morning, we were wake up by the sound of planes. And we imagined that it was the beginning of the invasion.
When did you go up into the mountains?
I was already in Lois, in the western side. The Indonesian troops occupied Ataba in the other side of the rivers. And by this, of course, automatically, I was in the jungle.
You evaded the Indonesian military for 17 years before your capture. How did you do that?
Maybe I was lucky. But I should tell you that I face the death many times in my eyes. But I was lucky. I was lucky. They didn't shoot me, and they could evade.
In those years, they were resupplied with weapons repeatedly by the United States. In 1975, 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. Did you see U.S. planes in the sky?
I I only can say that I saw Bronco OVBD, OVB-10. I saw Mirage. I saw many other military aircraft, but we could not recognize what Merck, what, and but yes, many types of many three or four types of warplane.
What were your thoughts about the United States at that time? I mean, you were not only up against Indonesia, the fourth largest country in the world, but you were up against the number one superpower in the world that was behind the Indonesian regime.
I can remind you of my plea. If they authorized me to read this in my defense, there I put United States, Portugal, after that Indonesia, to respond to the trial, but not me. But I understand that it was in a context of Cold War. And I must tell you also that very recently I went to Jakarta to hand over my invitations, and I was asked to by the Parliament upper house, by members of the upper house, to understand the position of Indonesia at that time. And I said, yes, I understood. And I must say also that we East Timorese also had responsibilities in this. Just to be fair to everyone, just to be fair in analyzing the process. I remember that it was a difficult time for the region, for Southeast Asia also. And in 1974 it was Vietnam liberation. In 1975, Vietnam came to Cambodia, to Laos. We have also some responsibility in all of this.
Over the period of the Indonesian occupation, 200,000 Timorese died, a third of the population. I just saw you inaugurating the Truth, the Reception, Truth, and Reconciliation Commission. What about the issue of justice that so many Timorese are talking about, the idea of an international criminal court to try those responsible for that level of killing?
I must tell you that when we talk about the reconciliation in our country, we see this problem at a whole. And when we talk about wounds, we talk about wounds amongst East Timorese. 74, 75. The president, chairman of the commission, said in his speech, why 74? Why not mentioning 7th of December 1975. Many people are still wounded or has still psychological, political wounds. We try to solve this problem, not only regarding to occupation, Indonesian military occupation, but amongst ourselves. We cannot focus the problem of justice just only to Indonesian military, but between ourselves also.
What about 1999, when the Indonesian military burned much of East Timor to the ground?
I just came from an interview asking me if what was received in East Timor. It was something that I supposed or expected. And I told him that we are thankful for the destruction, because and we already start to prove this, that we don't owe to anybody. Of course we owe some infrastructure, but it could make us more aware of the difficulties of the independence. Of course, in these 2 years and a half, we spent many more money to rebuild. But after we rebuild, we feel that it is our. It is by our own effort, if not people effort, but people contribute, at least not having the facilities that they could have. Something that we feel that better building the country from the ashes than receiving a country already built. The destruction, of course, if it was only the destruction of the Indonesian administrative infrastructure, we could accept. The destruction was directed to the people belongings. Of course, it is something cruel, something that we could not accept, but now we are living in this, and we must do our best to prove that we can surpass these difficulties.
Shanana Gushmao, founding president of East Timor. We'll be back with him in a minute.
The foreign militia stole away.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Dili, East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with a conversation with Xanana Gusmão, founding president of East Timor.
Classification of serious crimes. I know that rape, killing, massive killing, are crimes against humanity. And by this classification, the justice will be done. Of course, we in East Timor, sometimes many people don't understand me and say that I am not defending justice. But if you go around the country, our people live in a very bad situation. After 2 years and a half, they cannot have money to send their children to school. I met people in the hamlets. Our government has no capability to send teachers, and they are trying to get from farmers, literate farmers, to teach their children. My preoccupation is more how to respond slowly but firmly the expectation of the independence. I should say, let to the prosecutors, to the judiciary, to take care of this issue that is important. We are more, I'm more concerned of how we, in 3 years, we can implement our programs.
In Nicaragua, in Cuba, they had programs like sending out doctors and teachers, university students into the countryside on literacy campaigns. Are there any plans like that?
Well, we don't have resources. And I told you before, we must change the mentality. We must change the mentality amongst us. I already told publicly that we have some doctors working in NGOs, international NGOs, because of money. And that before they refused to work to the government because of less money. And in 1 to 3 years, I will appeal for new nationalism spirit, new contribution, and essentially in areas like this. And we cannot afford big, ambitious planning. What I'm trying with my presidency is to involve the civil society, to ask the community to contribute to the development. It is why one of my the first priority will be how to build a mechanism by which the products from the farmers are bought, to give them money to improve their life, to have hope. After that, I believe that after a situation in which people start to receive money, it is not material in a materialistic way of thinking, but they must, from our side, we give value to their work. From their side, they receive benefits from their work, and benefits that can allow them or can help them to contribute after our people in all scale of life or in all degree of life have something, receive some benefits, we can mobilize our people in this term.
Let me ask you, President Xanana Gusmão, as East Timor moves to independence, you move from a culture of resistance and unity and also secrecy as you took on a common enemy to one of openness. How do you move to one of openness and dissent overall feeling that debate is not going to threaten a unified push against a common enemy?
It is our problem. It is we are in transition, in changing of behaviors. After we won, we gained the opportunity of difference also. We are now trying to make sure that the difference is not, doesn't signify that you have an enemy. In all this process, I tried with the CNRT members to build a consciousness that the past is the past. If there were heroes, they are heroes of the past until 3rd of August. Now, we need new heroes in participating, in contributing. Very recently, after Constituent Assembly, we started, civil society, we started to put some difference, to express some difference of opinion. And many people asked us, many people, essentially the media, analyze the problem as conflict between East Timorese. We continue just to prove that difference of opinion are not conflict. And we did this, even with the majority party, the ruling party, we could establish a new perception that in democracy we must have difference. We must express our difference. We must be free of expressing our difference. And one of my programs is to help also civil society to be strong and be democratic. I believe that if we have a judiciary, an independent judiciary, if we push an independent media, we are building the basis of democracy here, of pluralism here. Of course, we are everything that we see here, we must see as an embryo. Of embryo of civil society, embryo of private sector, embryo of everything, embryo. It is why we are still in transitional period to strengthen the principles, the values. I believe that we can do this.
Your final thoughts on, I know you have to go visit your mother, far be it from me to stop you from doing that wonderful act, but on the role of the international solidarity movement now that you become a new nation, and just your final thoughts on becoming the founding president of a new nation.
First of all, I would like to thank all the solidarity movements around the world. I already said, I can repeat it again and again, that our victory is also the victory of all the solidarity movements. Now, I must say that the solidarity movement around the world can start thinking how to help, not sending money, not sending clothes, but how to help the civil society, how to help our press, how to help in many, many other things. I can give an example. I went to Macau. I talked about the situation of our population, about the situation of former fighters or former cadres of a clandestine organization. And a lady told me that, yes, I'm ready to help you. But in concrete measures or in concrete ways, I can help a child from the veterans, paying the expense, the fees, school fees, with one condition. He or she must be very must study. In the first year that he or she lose, I will help other. Something like this. And if one people help one people here, we can improve the situation of our people. Don't think about big question, big way of helping. Think about the strengthening of relationship between people, individual or in a group. In Fainan, I went there, far away from Same, far away from Alas, far away from Turiscaya and Mobisi. They don't have money to send their children to live in Same or Turiscaya or Alas. They are children. Our government could not help them because we don't have enough money to put schools everywhere. The farmers organized themselves, asked for who could start teaching them in basic school. And when I went there, they asked only for paper, for pencils, for something to help. It was their initiative. They understood the difficulties of our government. But they didn't want to leave their children illiterate in something like this. It is why I appeal to the international solidarity, to East Timor. We won together. Now we are facing new struggle to reduce the poverty, to reduce the illness, famine, to relieve our people from daily difficulties, daily problems. And I believe that, of course, yesterday, today, donor countries committed themselves to help the government. But it will not be something that can do a miracle in 3 years. In these 2.5 years, when you go to isolated hamlets, they say, we know nothing about independence. We are living worse than before. And it's why, if as country, as government, as state, we are thankful to the international community for the help to allow us to implement our program for 3 years in isolated areas, our people need to feel this solidarity. And it is a good time to the solidarity movement to start thinking how to help.
And your role as founding president?
My role as founding president, to coordinate your help, to help our people. Because I promise to the people that I will go again and again to talk with them, to listen to them, and to try to solve, complementing the efforts of the government, and try to gather civil society, NGOs, internationals, nationals, NGOs, private sector, to start thinking how we can solve, we can help people feeling that the independence is a hope for them. It is only my role. I was elected by my programs, and I have this difficult task to respond to the expectations of my electors and all the people of East Timor.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Xanana Gusmão. In just days, he'll become the founding president of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. And that does it for today's program. Tomorrow, journalist Alan Nairn will be in East Timor, and we'll co-host Democracy Now! Together. On Sunday, we'll be bringing you a special live 3-hour coverage of the Independence Day celebration. In East Timor, it's midnight when Kofi Annan, UN Secretary General, hands the torch to Xanana Gusmão. We'll be broadcasting this event, which will occur earlier in the day in the United States on Sunday, May 19th, on community radio stations around the country. Democracy Now! Is produced in East Timor with Brad Simpson and Rick Rowley, in New York with Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. From East Timor, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!